Do you have a busy summer planned? Are you worried about making time for your garden? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our gardening show, we'll discuss low-maintenance gardening trends, plus tips for building a low-cost garden bed if you're a beginner, and answers to all your questions for the full hour. Joining me now to get the show started are Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher. Welcome back, Corey.
Thanks for having me back.
Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator, Kamisha Montgomery. Always great to have you, Kamisha.
Thank you. Welcome back.
And OSU Extension State Master Gardener Program Director, Pam Bennett. Thanks for being here, Pam.
And thanks for the invite.
They are ready for your questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. Okay, Kamisha, is it too late to start a backyard vegetable garden? And if not, how should you prepare space for success?
Oh, no, it's definitely not too late to start a backyard garden. You just have to know what to plant. Different varieties have different maturity rates, so you can definitely get started now. Some of the things that you'll want to think about as far as like site preparation, how much sunlight that you have, how much sun exposure, what pests have you already noticed in your backyard? Any critters that you should be aware of before you get started, and how to protect your gardening space from those critters? But definitely, it's not too late. This is a great time to get started. I mean, we have a lot of rain right now, so you really don't have to get out there in the very high temperatures. And yeah, it's a great time.
Yeah. How do you decide, Kamisha, whether to use raised beds, in-ground beds, or containers?
Well, first, if you're growing in ground, if that is your idea of how you want to plan out your garden, I would suggest that you get a soil sample or know the history of your space. That's always, you know, the first thing that you can do. You can always reach out to your extension office or Hamilton County Conservation District that can help you out with getting a great soil sample to prepare your in-ground bed. But if you may have like mobility issues and you just can't kneel or bend as much, you might want an elevated raised bed. So there's different ways to make sure that you're able and capable of having that backyard garden that you seek.
Pam, what do you really think about when you're deciding where to put that garden bed, whatever kind you're planning? What are you really thinking about when it comes to where to put it?
Well, there's two key critical components. And one is you want as much sun as possible. So all day if possible, if not, where you're going to get the most sun. And the second one is easy access to water. Because by the time you get everything growing, we get to July and August and it gets dry. It's really a pain to drag your hose too far out in the yard to get to the garden. So those two things are really critical. Then you've got to think about other things like the septic system. You don't want to be anywhere near that. You know, anything in your yard that might be a barrier or something. And then the one final thing, and this is really a random thing that people don't really think about, is are there walnut trees nearby? And the reason for that is walnut trees give off a toxin called juglone that prevents tomatoes and anything in that family from growing. So make sure there's no walnut trees nearby. And if there are and you still want a garden, you can do a raised bed so that the roots aren't in the soil where the roots of the walnut would be.
Oh, so interesting. I had never thought about the whole walnut tree thing, Corey. Is that something you've thought about when you're deciding where to grow and what to grow?
It is. And even some, you know, native plants will be affected by walnuts too. It's a common problem. And a lot of people want to know, what can I plant under my walnut? Well, walnuts had a few, you know, million years of evolution to figure out how to get rid of its competition. So yeah, you really do need to think about where you're going to put your beds. If we're going to all the trouble of building them and bringing the soil and everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Might as well.
So is there anything you can plant under your walnut?
There are. So one of the tips that I usually have for people is just, first, natives tend to do a little bit better because a lot of them have evolved with walnut, so they can withstand it a little bit better. And then it's also a great place if you like bird baths, bird feeders, swing sets, you can use the area under those black walnuts for some of those things because they don't really care if the soil has jug loam in it or not. So, you know, really it's more a matter of organizing your yard around where can I plant, where can't I plant, and then just having a map of your yard. I think a lot of people forget about the importance of just having that map drawn out and just writing on it, where am I going to have my tomatoes versus hosta versus where are the deer, where do they hit the yard the hardest?
Mm-hmm. Well, Kamisha, what are your tips for building a sustainable, low-cost garden bed? If somebody's just getting started and they think, I want to do this, what are some good ideas for that?
Well, to be more sustainable and using more organic materials, I like the Hugelkultur method. It's very low cost, just using what you have available. What you may have around your yard already are great, valuable materials to build your Hugelkultur. There's several different ways that you can start a Hugelkultur. You can either dig a ditch into your ground and sort of fill it with the different materials. The lowest material that you'll want to put in is like the more dense materials, such as like more logs, then sticks, then a little bit of straw. Make sure it's straw, not hay, because if you put hay in there, you'll be growing hay. But straw along with some wood chips, and then maybe some old grass clippings, old leaf mulch, then your compost, your topsoil, and things like that. So you can either dig a ditch, or you can just add those materials on top of your garden bed. Say, for instance, if you have some soil issues, this is a great way to get started also. And as time progresses, that material will start to compose, and you'll have great soil to build on and grow in. And there are some ways that you can also, utilize other materials to build your garden bed. You can use logs that you might have around. Instead of going out to your big box store and getting lumber, you can utilize some of those logs as far as your frame. So there's some non-expensive or cost-saving measures that you can take as far as what you might have around your home to build your garden bed.
Back in the day, I used to see railroad ties used all the time. Is that a bad idea, a good idea? That doesn't seem to be as fashionable as it once was.
I think it depends on what the wood has been preserved with. A lot of the sort of treated lumber, including some railroad ties, can be treated with everything from fossil fuels to toxins to prevent them from rotting. So just being careful with, if you're going to put something, if you're going to build your raised beds, you should be able to look at what has it been treated with so that you can make sure it's okay for ground contact, but it's also not filled with chemicals that might leach into the soil.
Yeah, definitely. You don't want to worry about arsenic. The whole thing and then the premise about growing your own food is to know where your food comes from and to know what is in the soil and things like that. So, if you're getting railroad ties donated to you, or you're using those, or if you're getting wood that might have been donated from an old barn, that's something that you really want to look into.
We're talking about gardening for the full hour today, and we've got experts here to answer your questions. We know you have questions. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Okay, Pam, so if you're just getting started with this vegetable patch and you're really excited about it, how do you go about deciding what to grow? I know you said avoiding walnut trees is something important to consider about placement, but what do you think? What should you consider about what goes in there?
You need to think about what you like and what your family is going to eat.
That seems like a very important tip.
Yeah, but we get those catalogs in, we go to the stores, the garden stores, we see all these seeds and everything just looks fantastic. So the first part of the year, everybody's excited. We want to plant everything. And I've gone year after year planting stuff that nobody eats. So it's like, okay, let's be smart about this and just plant what people eat and plant the amount that people are going to eat. And if you have extra, are you going to donate it? I like to try all different varieties of tomatoes. So I will plant more tomatoes than I need, but you can always donate it to a local food bank. And then the other thing is, are you canning? Are you freezing? And then you think about the length to harvest, because if everything comes on at once, what are you going to do with it? A good example, I love to plant edamame or the edible soybeans, But 1 year I planted a whole bunch and they all came on at the same time. And we just had so many, I couldn't do anything with them. The next time I went and purchased an 80-day soybean and a 90-day soybean and a 110-day soybean. And that way I had them kind of spread out. So that first year, people get real excited. You kind of want to, you know, look at it and say, okay, what are we going to eat? What do we want to try? And don't go overboard, because you, again, you get into July and August when it's hot, the weeds start really growing. You got to water. You really want to think about, you know, okay, what am I actually going to use to make me successful and happy and love this opportunity, instead of like being, you know, oh my God, I got to weed again. Make it a good outcome by planting the things that you like and you're going to consume, or you're going to freeze or save.
Yeah. Kamisha, are there some crops that you're more likely to have success with too? I mean, I imagine if you're just starting, you want to plant something that you're pretty confident is going to grow.
Yeah, definitely. So you want to make sure that you're growing in season crops. So once it starts to get a little bit warmer, I wouldn't start to put out, or I wouldn't continue to have any cold crops in my garden because of the fear of bolting. The plants are starting to go to seed, which is susceptible for more pests to come to your garden. So that, you know, with that being said, you also want to think about when you're starting your garden out, like she said, making sure that you're planting what you like, but also making sure that the plants are together with plants that they like. So some plants also have, you know, different disease issues. So you don't want to plant the same crops that have those same disease issues next to each other, making sure that if you're thinking about a garden and you have a minimal amount of space, making sure that you are utilizing that space by not only growing vertically, but also growing horizontally, and making sure that you have all of those materials readily and available. But also learning about the different varieties of a specific crop is very important. So if you you love tomatoes, and you don't want them to all be harvested at the same time because you're not ready for the food preservation aspect of it, look into maybe a determinate tomato versus an indeterminate tomato so that you'll have that continuous harvest throughout the season.
Yeah. Corey, if you don't want to deal with everything all at once, is it a good idea to try harvesting maybe some green tomatoes for fried green tomatoes? Yeah. But you don't want to take too many tomatoes, right? What's the balancing act there?
So I tend to plant more tomatoes than I know what to do with. and I always have the ones that I know do well in my garden. And then the ones that I'm like, oh, this sounds kind of interesting, let's try this year. You know, having grown up in the South, fried green tomatoes, absolutely something that I will harvest and make. You know, I think it, if you're going to have a garden and you're going to take the time to care for it, I think it is important to be reasonable and not set yourself up for failure. And if you fill your garden with plants, assume the best. What if you wind up with tomatoes on every single one of those plants? Do your neighbors have tomatoes that they need? Do you like to harvest early on in the season? Like pickles, for example, I think there's some cucumbers that you can harvest early for pickles and you can let them go later for certain other dishes. So I think it's being creative when you plan it and assuming the best. Assume that you're going to have more vegetables than you know what to do with.
Okay. We got an email from Pat. Pat writes, I planted two small Weigela, don't know if I'm saying that right, midnight wine shine shrubs last spring. They both leafed out early this spring. Then one of them died back and is now completely dead. The other looked fine and bloomed, but is now starting to die back. A couple of the branches are completely wilted and the others don't look great. I've looked online for explanations for what the problem might be, but nothing seems to fit the situation I'm experiencing with my shrubs. Any thoughts? Pam, are you familiar with this plant, the midnight wine shine?
Yeah, it's a Weigela. And unfortunately, these plants aren't 100% hardy in our area. They have a tendency every so many years to lose some branches, have some dieback. Part of what we saw this year also is plants leafed out. And then we got that freeze back. I don't know. It was like a late April. It got down into the upper 20s overnight when things were nice and green and tender. And a lot of foliage was damaged. I wouldn't give up on it yet. I would just wait and see if any of it comes out. I would probably cut it back. Maybe the one that's not back to the ground, I'd cut it back about halfway and see if you can encourage new growth. The one that you said the leaves, you know, wilted, that may be the one that was hit by frost. The other one may or may not have made it through the winter. Every year I have a couple of weigelias, and every year I have some dieback on them. And shrubs in general need to be kind of pruned and cleaned out each year. The old growth removed, the new growth encouraged, and any damaged wood removed. But that's a real common problem for your weigelias.
Anything you want to add to that, Corey?
So the one that I have at home, I will agree with all of that. The one that I have, I had a similar issue, and I gave it a really hard prune probably, I don't know, 4 years ago or so. And it came right back, sort of the renew prune, you call it. It came right back, and it's gorgeous now. So she was exactly right. When I pruned mine like that, it did encourage more growth, and it came back looking good as new.
Okay. Well, Pat, I sure hope that helps. We are going to continue our gardening show after a short break. Now is the perfect time to call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our gardening show. My guests are Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator Kamisha Montgomery, OSU Extension State Master Gardener Program Director Pam Bennett, and Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation Corey Christopher. You can join the conversation. Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Now, we've got some other stuff to talk about, but during the break, I have to bring this up. Corey was talking about his favorite way to prepare fried green tomatoes, and I just think that is something we need to share with everyone listening. Let's just not keep it to ourselves. Please, Corey, share that wisdom.
Okay, so it's grilled cheese, basically. Get sourdough bread. As if you're going to make a grilled cheese, but then you just insert your fried green tomatoes and breaded fried green tomatoes, like, you know, real fried green tomatoes, just insert those in with the cheese between the sourdough bread, and then do your grilled cheesing, I guess. And it is incredible. It's fantastic. Little brown mustard on there, and it's fantastic.
Okay. I think we're going to have a lot of happy people who are glad that you shared that information with them. So thank you. I appreciate that. Well, let's get to this, Pam. Let's talk about chaos gardening. It seems to be all the rage on the TikTok. What is it?
It's what it sounds like. And it really mimics more of nature, natural plantings. You know, prairie areas, your meadows, things are here and there, planting all over the, in your landscape. No formal landscape plan. So if you think a formal house, you know, with a front door and right side, left side, everything matches, this would be a little bit different than that. And it's up to your perspective if you like it or not. My daughter prefers everything matching. So if there's a flower on one side of the bed, the other end has to match. She does not like anything chaos or out of order. Me, on the other hand, I plant according to the plants that I like and bring them home and say, okay, now where am I going to put this? So it kind of helps people, I think, in terms of take away the fear of doing something wrong, you know, knowing that, you know, you can put it in there. If it doesn't work, you can plant it somewhere else, transplant it. But it just allows people a little more freedom to not have to worry about the guidelines of a good landscape design.
Okay. And it's just about kind of mixing up those seeds and throwing them on some gently prepared ground and then putting soil underneath. I mean, over it. Is that what it comes down to, Pam?
It would be that. It could be that. It could also be just like my landscape. I would consider my landscape chaos gardening because I do sort of have a design for my perennial bed in my head. But again, I like plants. So if I find a plant that doesn't necessarily fit with the design, I'll still find a place for it. So it can be that, you know, that kind of like buying plants and so forth, or it can be seed starting. And I guess what I really like to compare it to would be a cottage garden, a native plant garden, that you don't really have anything planted. It'd be like mimicking nature.
Okay. Well, we have a caller on the line. Hi, Katie. Thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
Hi. I was curious, for someone with limited gardening space, what is a native goldenrod they'd recommend planting?
Corey's eyes just lit up with that question, Katie. I'm going to let Corey take that one.
So I've got two. If you've got a sunny spot, I really love showy goldenrod. It's a little harder to find, but it's gorgeous. It does not take over. It's got these giant, beautiful yellow blooms. So that's great for sunny spot. And then there's blue-stemmed goldenrod, which is better for sun or for shadier conditions. Smaller yellow flowers. Again, it's not like the Canada goldenrod that tends to take over. So either showy goldenrod or blue-stemmed goldenrod.
And those are both natives?
They're both native.
Yep. Wow. Okay. Well, Katie, I hope that helps.
Yes. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. Okay, so I want to come back to chaos gardening. Corey, is it smart to do a little research before you just scatter seeds all over the place? I mean, is that a good idea? Like knowing what kinds of things grow best and the kind of soil you have?
Yes. So I like to go into any new planting knowing, first, like Kamisha said, what's going on in the soil? But sometimes more importantly, does it get enough sun? Is it going to get enough water? Does that area tend to dry out a lot? So I do go in with a plan, and I know what the plants like. But then kind of like Pam said, as the season progresses, I start to see which plants like it in which areas. And I'll see volunteer plants, I call it, coming in. You know, native plants that might have blown in and really like one area of my yard. And instead of trying to fight it, I work with it and say, okay, well, that plant tends to like that area. I'm going to go with nature on this one, and I'm just going to encourage that plant there. So yes, absolutely do your research, but also use your power of observation around you and pay attention to what tends to do well where, and instead of, you know, fighting it, just go with it and allow nature to sort of guide your design a little bit.
And take notes and remember.
Yeah, take notes. If you're like me, every single year I'll put something in fall and think I'm going to remember exactly where this is in the spring, and I never do.
Okay.
So
go for it, Pam.
If I can echo your comment about the power of observation, that is so important in gardening and horticulture, and you learn so much if you look closely. You know, there's this thing we call plant blindness that people don't even know about plants and different flowers, and they don't even know their plants have problems, but they just don't look closely. But like he said, observing and knowing what's doing well where, and kind of like the survival of the fittest in this case. And but that's a great, great point to make.
And I also looking when you have a new plant come in, you may want to call a weed. I always suggest figuring out what the plant is first. And finding a picture online of what it's going to look like when it flowers. And you may realize that is a gorgeous little plant, and it's a native. And oh yeah, they sell that at a nursery, but it's growing wild in my yard.
It's for free.
Exactly. And so just being very patient and not trying to rip everything out of your yard the minute it comes up, you'll find that there are plants that are coming in by themselves, and they choose where in your yard they want to go.
Yeah. Well, we've got some emails. We have an email from Usha who writes, what are the best deer-resistant flowering plants for Ohio? Also, what is the best deer repellent? Pam, what do you think?
I'm so sorry. So the bottom line with any critters is if they're hungry enough, they are going to eat it. So the better way to look at this is, what are the plants you don't want to put in? Because if you have deer and you have a habitat where they're going to come in, learn about the deer first. They are very, routine oriented. They go the same spots. They walk the same path. And once they create that path, they're going to keep coming back. And if you have candy there for them, the flowers they like, they're going to definitely come back. Hosta are one of their favorites, arborvitas, taxus, those things they really like, they're going to eat. So there are some plants, like for instance, a perennial that I use that they don't touch is hellebores. They bloom real early in the spring. But they love then, of course, the tulips. They don't eat daffodils or hyacinths because they're poisonous for them. So again, going back to that observation to see in other landscapes, to see what they like is a way to find out, you know, some of the best plants. In our trial gardens, we know the ones they love, and then they kind of stay away from some of the ones that have like a rough leaf, like lantana, they don't like. Yesterday, I had planted my containers outside, and last night I noticed the verbena had been pulled out but was not eaten, and that has kind of a rough leaf to it. And I know it's the deer because last year in the same pots, they ate all of my cannas. So they touched it, tasted it, and didn't like it, so they just dropped it on the ground.
So that was like a protest vote, Pam?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then the best deer repellent that I have found, and there are others, but the best deer repellent I found is repellent is called plant skid, S-K-Y-D-D. It is somewhat vile in the liquid form. It is 98% blood meal or dried blood. It smells awful. You want to use gloves that won't be saturated by it because it really smells bad. But it lasts for our trial gardens. It lasts for about 3 weeks. You do have to reapply. But the biggest thing is preventing them from getting a habit already set up. So if you find them coming into the landscape, start using this immediately so that they see, okay, this is not a place I want to go. So I'm not going to go back because they're very routine oriented. And again, with any critter, our wildlife specialist, Marnie Tishnell, talks about learn about the critter, learn about their life cycle, learn about their habitat, and then, you know, take the appropriate measures. You know, if you live in West Virginia, you have to have a 10-foot high fence if you're going to do any kind of vegetable gardening. Well, that's not always feasible for people. So there might be some individual plants that you have to put chicken wire or fencing around. If you really want that plant and know the deer are going to come after it, you're going to have to take some precautions to exclude them.
Now, Kamisha, haven't I heard you in the past talking about planting a little extra for our wildlife friends? Talk about your
Definitely.
Philosophy with that.
So what I like to, my philosophy around, you know, just the environment and what we're growing as far as like edible crops and different pests, I always believe in a type of companion planting called trap cropping, where basically, you know what the deer like or you know what the critters like, and you've observed their presence in your garden via just, you know, a visual, or you've seen them or you've seen damage to your plants and things like that. But yeah, just planting a little bit of what they like over to the side. So you're basically, it's like a perimeter that hopefully they stay over in that area that is attracting them to that space and not entering what you desire to have for your harvest. So there's a little give and take with gardening. And that is one of the ways that I like to make sure that, you know, our environment is being taken care of and we're paying attention to that whole food web system. You know, just making sure that we are being fed, they are being fed, but they're staying away from what we desire mostly.
Okay. We got an email from Jody. Jody writes, I love aspen trees from living out west and miss them here. Will a quaking aspen survive here? And if not, do you have any suggestions for something similar with white bark? I'm going to ask you about that, Corey.
You can get quaking aspen to survive here. I'm actually, you know, really fond, if you like that sort of the leaf shape and the motion of the leaves. I really love cottonwoods. A lot of people don't love cottonwoods because of the fluff. I happen to really like them. In terms of white bark trees, if you really like that look, you really can't beat sycamores. I know I live in Loveland, so it's a little lower, wetter. So we have sycamore all over the place. So I know some people can get a little annoyed with sick of sycamore, right? But they're so gorgeous when they get older, and their bark is so interesting. But so I would say those two, I think, are good options, depending on how big your yard is. And there's also river birch. You know, I think we forget about the birches. The bark peels off and you get that white bark underneath. So river birch, great if you have a smaller yard.
Okay. We have another caller on the line. Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for listening. What's your question or comment?
I have two. One, the difference between determinate and indeterminate plants, like, for example, in tomatoes, is the determinant. All the tomatoes bloom, ripen at one time. The indeterminate, it's spread out over a period of time. So I think perhaps the lady misspoke or I misunderstood her. The second one is for deer issues. We have used for 5 years now a granular product that comes in a plastic jug from Sweden, I believe. My husband gets it online, called Plant Skid, SKYDD. It's granular. We put it on in May. We put it on again in July. The deer never touch our hostas. And we do have lots of deer in the yard.
Okay. Thanks, Jane. I think, Pam, is that the product that you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, there's two types. There's the liquid that you can spray on, and there's also the granular. And we happen to use both. So that's good to know how long you're getting control out of it.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Jane. We appreciate that call. Okay, Pam, that question, if this is, I can't remember what you called it, the blood term that you used.
Blood meal.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Is that, I mean, how do they get that? That is that ethically sourced? Where does that come from?
Yes, it is ethically sourced, and it is either a dried blood. We use blood meal for fertilizer. So it's usually from animals. And I don't know exactly how they do it or how they create it. That's a good question. But it is ethically sourced, and it's very commonly in, it's actually in a lot of our animal repellent products.
Okay. And you're not familiar with the animals or how they're kept or any of that kind of stuff?
No, but when they smell that it definitely prevents them from coming. And like I said, there are other ways to do it. And there are other products that contain this. The reason I like Plant Skid is because of the high concentration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I know that we sometimes get calls or questions about wolf urine. And my understanding is that there are a lot of concerns about that, how cruel it is, because the wolf protection groups claim that it's very cruelly sourced, that they're caged, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. I don't know if you've heard much about that, Pam.
Nope. My friends, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but many of them go outside and do their job outside around the hostas.
Oh, they just do it themselves. Take care of the,
yeah.
Okay. No need for the wolf.
There you go.
Just take a big drink of water and get busy, I guess, huh?
Okay. Yeah. But again, I really need to emphasize the fact that it's just preventing them from setting up that habit. Because once they learn they're not going to be harmed, they're safe. You know, people put out these, foxes, the little caricature-like thing, a fox, you stick it in the ground, it's supposed to scare them, or a snake, plastic snake. If you don't move that every day like it's alive, they keep getting closer and they realize, hey, this is not going to bother me, so it, you know, doesn't work. So there's things you have to do to really beat them at their game.
Okay. Well, we will be back to wrap up our gardening show after a short break. If you've got questions, you are running out of time. So call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with today's gardening show. My guests are OSU Extension State Master Gardener Program Director, Pam Bennett, Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher, and Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator, Kamisha Montgomery. If you've got questions, they've got answers. Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And we have Rob on the line. Hi, Rob. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
I have a number of green ash trees coming up around the perimeter of my yard. In the back of the yard, there's old dead ash trees. I'm just wondering if these new green ash trees popping up are going to survive, or will they meet the same fate as the older ash trees?
Corey, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, the bad news is they are probably not going to live to maturity. Usually by the time they're about 2.5 or 3 centimeters wide, that's when they become susceptible to the ash borer. I think we've come a long way at eradicating the ash borer, but we still have a long way to go. And so I would say they probably aren't going to make it unless you chose a couple of the larger, sort of more hardy ones and begin treating them for the ash borer. I think then they have a chance. But by and large, most of those small ones are unfortunately probably not going to make it to maturity.
Yeah. Well,
can I add to this? I'm sorry.
Sure. Please do.
But one of the things that you might do also is if they're not too close to the house, if they're in an area that you can let them grow and you're okay with it, I would let them grow because there's research now coming out of Michigan where we are watching to see if some of these new ash seedlings are resistant. Mm-hmm. So these would be seedlings coming from, you know, your tree that was there. They're looking like in the woodland areas after ash borer has gone through, you've got trees coming back up. And yes, like Corey said, they're still here. They're still around, but they're not in the numbers that they used to be. And if you, because everywhere I go, if I see an ash tree that's still growing, I'm going to check to see if it's resistant or if it's being treated. And that's one of the things that researchers are doing right now to try to find out, okay, now that it's gone through, wiped out all of our native ashes, let's see if there is something coming back that might be resistant to it.
Well, this is like the plot of so many zombie movies. So, well, thank you, Rob. Good luck with those ash trees. We'll keep our fingers crossed for you. And we've got Mike on the line. Hi, Mike. What's your question or comment?
Hey, I was just wondering, what are the best practices? So, like, I casted up a small herb garden on an apartment balcony. I'm trying to right now grow some cilantro, but they just kind of keep wilting and dying.
Okay. Kamisha, do you have tips for Mike?
Yeah, you can definitely do a container garden on a patio or a balcony, especially if you don't have a lot of space. I think one of the things that you really want to monitor and pay attention to is how much sunlight exposure that you have, especially for like parsley and cilantro. Cilantro grows best when it's a little bit cooler temperatures. So, you know, you'll want to try to grow that in the spring or in the late summer. It's when you have most success from it not bolting and going to flower. But also with container gardens, you really want to pay attention to the type of container that you are using, because some can retain water, while others you'll need to water more than what you would a traditional garden, like a raised bed or in-ground garden bed.
Okay. And Mike told our producer that he has hardly any sun exposure. Could that be part of the problem too, Kamisha?
Well, not necessarily. It sounds like it might be a watering problem if it's cilantro and he doesn't have a lot of sun exposure and it's dying back. I would say it's more of a watering issue, a consistent watering issue. So you might want to switch containers. I don't know what type of container you're using, but you know, you should be successful with cilantro in part sun.
Okay. Well, thanks,
check
Mike.
Check your soilless mix too. If he's using like garden soil that he just pulled in, that could be the same thing she's talking about with too wet. So make sure you're using a soilless mix.
Okay. Well, thanks, Mike. Good luck with that cilantro. We now have Sharon on the line. Hi, Sharon.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I'm actually calling on behalf of my neighbor. She has a beautiful birch tree next to her neighbor's concrete driveway. They recently replaced the driveway, and in the process, they cut out a huge root, and she's concerned that her tree may not make it. And I'm curious, is that true? And is there something she can do to help the tree after being, you know, after the root was chopped off?
What do you think, Corey?
If the root was one of the sort of the main roots of the tree, it could very well really injure the tree, potentially fatally. The only thing that she could really do, I would suggest first making sure that if we do see, I know right now it's raining outside, but if we do get into a period where it gets a little drier, make sure that she's watering trees. I mean, trees in general, I think we forget that sometimes our trees need water too. So making sure to keep it watered. I would probably have a tree service come out and just look at it, just to give her an idea of, you know, exactly how big the root was compared to how large the tree is. anytime you damage one of the roots of a tree like that, you do risk everything from infection to the tree falling. So I would say if ask the tree service in particular if the tree might wind up falling on a house or a car or a person. So that's my concern, hearing that it seems like it's that close to the house and having that large of a root cut. That's when I say call in the professionals to give you a little more peace of mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for calling on behalf of your neighbor, Sharon. I hope that information helps. And we have Janet on the line. Hi, Janet.
Hi. My question is, how do you get rid of chipmunks? They are tunneling through the garden, around the house, everywhere. I'm infested with them.
That does not sound cute. Okay. Kamisha, you have any chipmunk tips?
Well, if as far as like your edible garden to protect them, I would say using like some chicken wire to protect them around your garden bed or around each individual plant. But I don't have anything that will like deter chipmunks from your garden, just how to protect those plants.
Yeah. Pam, do you have any advice?
Well, people aren't going to like it, but it's trapping them, and you can get them with rat traps if you want to eliminate the populations. But the other thing, too, populations of animals like this tend to rise and fall. So if there are cats in the neighborhood, I mean, this is, you know, the basic cycle of life. If there's cats and other things in the neighborhood that would eliminate them, that would help. But when populations are really high, eventually something comes along and populations crash. So other than excluding them, and some of the deer and rabbit repellents also work on chipmunks, you could try those as well.
Okay. Well, good luck, Janet. We got another chipmunk question from Anne. She emailed, "We have chipmunks that get through any chicken wire we try. Any suggestions? And the rabbits in our yard eat my lilies. Suggestions for this?"
Well, yeah, since the chicken wire doesn't work. I was going to say when the other caller sent in their question, I was going to mention also maybe a row cover. But if the chicken wire is not even protecting, I don't think the row cover will be any different. There's really not a good solution. One of the things you can do as far as like for an edible garden is try to elevate the garden bed. An elevated garden bed is not only for folks that might have mobility issues, but also protecting those crops, and see if that helps. That's also a way that you can sort of deter a lot of other pests also. Getting an elevated bed and chicken wire. Try that.
Oh, okay. Corey, you think there's any chance the rabbits would leave the lilies alone if Anne let her dandelions grow? Would they go for the dandelions instead?
Maybe. I think it depends. It depends on the rabbit. I was actually going to say, funny enough, I do have an issue with rabbits in my own yard. And I found using, you can get reed fencing in like, I think it's like 6 foot tall, but you can cut it into like 2 feet segments. And I have like a two-layer system where I have the chicken wire and then I have the reed fencing on the outside to, one, cover the chicken wire, but then the chipmunks can't get through it. That has helped in my yard, but I don't know how to get bunnies to eat what you want them to eat, because the ones in my yard eat anything they can get to.
Are they afraid of like plastic owls or anything like that?
I think if you move the owl around enough, they work. But if I have time to move the owl around, I might as well just be out there as a scarecrow anyway. So I think it's tough.
Okay. We got an email from Jim. What should I use to keep ants from eating my strawberries without using toxic insecticides? What do you think, Kamisha?
Well, ants are all over the place. I've just put down and just sprinkled some cinnamon around my doorstep and window sills. And I have seen a decrease in carpenter ants around my house. That's something that you can use in a garden that shouldn't be harmful. I think that's something that you can try to use.
Yeah. Pam, anything you want to add to that? Keeping those ants away from the strawberries?
I would say if you have straw, putting straw down, keeping the strawberry, the berry themselves, up off the ground. Ants don't usually eat strawberries. That's not their primary food source. But if the berry is broken or has a little cut in it or a little slit, they're going to go after that juice or the water that's in them. So keeping it up off the ground will help prevent them from climbing up through there and getting on the berries a little bit.
Okay. Pam, do you have any other tips for kind of low maintenance gardening? We were talking about chaos gardening earlier. Can it be helpful to plant with pollinators in mind so they kind of help you with some of the work?
Well, the thing is, it would be really great if our meadows and prairies, native plant gardens, pollinator gardens were low maintenance. they're lower maintenance than some, but they still need some maintenance. If you first start out, you're going to have weeds. So you've got to figure out, weed control. I've got a quarter acre prairie and we have to burn it or mow it tight every so many years. Because if you don't, I've already got some cottonwoods growing in it, and nothing about cottonwoods because, Corey, I love cottonwoods too. I think we're one of the very few people. Most people hate them, but I think they're great. But I don't want them coming up in the middle of the prairie, some calorie pears. So while these gardens are lower in maintenance, they're definitely not no maintenance. So you do have to work a little bit on them. Yeah. And I think going back to what Corey said, do your research. People see these things on TikTok and it's like, oh, this looks great. This will be easy. But when you see it on TikTok, question it, because I saw a plant repellent thing the other day that's supposed to send out sonic vibes. And the video was hilarious because this guy screws it into a hole and all of a sudden all these snakes and rabbits and all these animals come running out. Of course, it was AI generated, but nonetheless, it doesn't quite work like that. So do your research, because there's just so much misinformation out there right now.
Yeah. And that AI can look real convincing, too.
For sure.
Corey, just in like 10 seconds, do you plant with birds in mind? You can kind of attract specific kinds of birds, can't you?
You can. If you think about your average chickadee with three or four chicks, it takes 7,500 caterpillars to raise a nest. And they need native plants to do that for those caterpillars.
Okay. So do your homework, help our birds, help our plant those natives. I've been talking with Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher, Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator, Kamisha Montgomery, and OSU Extension State Master Gardener Program Director, Pam Bennett. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director today is Stephen Baum. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.